The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, I think we can all agree that the topic that I've been asked to deal with this evening is a difficult and controversial one. I suppose as you look at the church today, you'd have a hard time finding a topic more difficult or controversial. It sort of is on the order of the issue of spiritual gifts and whether or not certain gifts have ceased in terms of controversy that's been generated. And that controversy is brought about, I think, we recognize too, because of developments that have taken place in our culture, at least the culture for most of us, and the result is to leave us somewhat off balance, to leave us with questions of our own, wondering just exactly where we should come out. But I think it's not only a matter of developments that have taken place, say, in the culture of the West in the last generation or so, but I think even more deeply is the fact that we come in this area and onto texts in the Bible that are just plain difficult, texts that the church has really wrestled with off and on through its history. So we have a difficult topic to deal with. And whenever you find yourself in difficulty, involved in situations in the church that are controversial, it's, I think, the first thing you want to do is to try to gain balance. You want, as the primary and most important thing, in the midst of all that may be confusing and difficult, you want to try to lay hold on what is clear in the Scriptures. And to anchor yourself, so to speak, by that clarity, and then move on into the more difficult areas. And that's really my goal with you tonight. For the most part, to try to establish certain foundations on this issue of the role of a Christian woman, and maybe just get a little bit beyond that into some of the more difficult issues, some of the more debatable issues. And so I'd really stress that these are some thoughts on Christian Roman's role. I'm not in any sense going to be able to be complete. I couldn't be complete as I was just sitting down today and putting this talk together. I became, in a sense, more and more intimidated by, not by you, but by some of the issues that come up and just what the answer ought to be. And at any rate, I can well imagine that the things I'm going to say are going to provoke all kinds of questions. I hope not too much outrage. And I will speak for a while, probably longer than I should. I've tried to keep control on things, but I am very much counting on a question and discussion period that we have afterward to clarify things and for you to raise issues that I won't touch on. But as we get to work, let's have prayer together. Our sovereign God, how thankful we are once more that you are sovereign, that we have your word, a sure and certain word, and that you have given it to be a lamp to our feet, light to our paths. Our God, we ask that you will help us to remember that more basic than our relationship to one another as men and women is our relationship together to you, before you as the true and living God. And may we always be concerned, above all, to be obedient to you in everything. We ask that the time we spend together this evening might further us in that obedience. For the sake of our Savior, amen. Now, as a point of departure getting into this whole area of discussion, I want to and that is to get a hold of, remember, what is primary, what is clear in Scripture on this issue. I want, as a first principle to work with or to proceed from, the principle that in reflecting upon ourselves as Christians, we need always to remember that we are creatures. Inevitably, when you're trying to understand yourself as a sinner, as a saved sinner, that pushes you back, in a sense, to what is a deeper reality, and that is that you are someone that God has made, that you are a creature. To put in more formal theological categories, whenever you consider redemption, whenever you consider the salvation that has been revealed and brought to us in Jesus Christ, that always brings us back to consider the creation and what the creation is. You can't set those two in opposition to each other. To be a thoughtful Christian is to be concerned about God's order for his creation. So I want to underline that when we are talking about the role of being a Christian woman, we're really talking about the role of being a Christian, of being a woman in the presence of God, before God. Being a Christian woman is not something in addition to being a woman, sort of added on, as it were. So all these things bring us certainly to the first passage that we have to discuss in getting into this whole area, and that is God's order established in creation at the beginning in Genesis 2. And if you have Bibles, I see some of you do, turn there. I imagine the passage is familiar to us, and I want to make just three or four points on this passage. First of all, it struck me as I was looking at this passage today that in Genesis 2, what we have in Genesis 1 and 2 is a description of the situation in the world before the fall, before sin came into the world, the order established by God in creation. And what I note is that really the whole discussion that we find at verse 18 around the creation of woman and the relationship of man and woman, that is really the most substantial, the lengthiest discussion of any, so far as any one item is concerned, in this passage. Now, looking then at verse 18 and following especially, the first thing we can focus in on is the statement of God that it was not good for man to be alone. Now, you see, that brings a negative note. A negative note, you see, is in the creation even before sin comes into the picture. God is what we have described here is a situation about which God cannot yet say, as he does at the end of chapter 1, the first account of creation that we have in the book of Genesis. Genesis 2 kind of parallels Genesis 1, picking up on particular themes. God cannot yet look at the creation and say it's all very good, because it is not good for man to be alone. So the what we're pointed to here as not good is a certain loneliness, a certain solitariness, a certain barrenness in the creation so far as man's existence is concerned. There is a lack, there is a need. With that then, we come to the end of verse 18, God's response to the observation, it's not good for man to be alone, is I will make a helper suitable to him. So we come then secondly to focus in on the reference, this description of the suitable helper. Literally, we could perhaps translate that, a helper suitable to man. Now, you see, that sounds the positive note. The negative note is answered by a positive note. This is good news for Adam. We could maybe even say at this point, this is the gospel for Adam, putting gospel in quotes there. The creation of woman, then, the creation of Eve, answers to the need, to the lack that is in Adam. Now, we need to think a little bit further, then, on the idea of the suitable helper. I think the key idea here is that the woman is to be a complement to man. Now we have to be sure how we spell that word here. It's complement with an E and not an I. Leaving all the business about fragile masculine egos to the side, woman was created to complement man with an E, not to complement man with an I. Maybe the I can come in there at some point too, but that's not the point here. Now I think bound up with this idea of woman as complement, that can be broken down into two facets. Woman is to be complement in the sense of a counterpart, and that is really, so far as I can see, the most literal sense of the idea of that's translated in English as suitable. The idea is of woman as one that is before, over, against a man. Woman as counterpart, and then also in view of the context, woman is complement. Not only as counterpart, but as completion. See, as she meets the lack or the need that is existing in man by himself. And I go on here to observe that so far as this idea of woman as helper is concerned, that does not of itself suggest the notion of subordination or of subservience. You can't find that in the reference here to woman as helper. A more literal way we could translate here is that the woman is to be one who helps. And that is an idea that can be applied in a various range of ways. A parent, for instance, could be described that way in relating to children. Or in fact, the same Hebrew word here, and this has probably been pointed out to some of you, the same Hebrew word that is here applied to the woman, helper, is applied to God himself on several occasions. Most notably, perhaps, or strikingly, Psalm 121, verse 1, I will lift up my eyes to the hills from whence comes my help, my helper, the Lord who made heaven and earth. So you can't read the idea of subordination out of the notion of helper here. And at any rate, Adam's need that is met by the creation of woman, that need is not the need of a creature at his disposal to dominate and domesticate, as it were. You see, the creation is filled with creatures like that, and they're described in verses 19 and 20. The whole animal creation is brought before, animate creation is brought before Adam, and the need that he, what is necessary to fill his need is not found there, is not found there. So that what Adam sees in Eve is what he has not seen elsewhere in the creation. And that is described in the kind of poetic words of verse 23, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. In other words, Adam sees in the woman both identity and difference. Identity and difference, the complement to who he is as man. Now, I think the idea then of the man as the head, I think that may be implicit in the passage here, but that is not spelled out, and that will come in later in the picture. So, we've seen the negative note, the positive note, and now the third point that I think I should make looking at this Genesis 2 passage, let me put it this way and then explain what I have in mind. The identity of the woman as suitable helper, that identity is not indiscriminate but exclusive. It is not indiscriminate but exclusive. In plainer words, or simpler English, or whatever, as helper, the woman is not a helper to every male. Rather, this helper relationship is realized in a relationship between man and woman, which is described in the language of verse 24 as being joined or united, and can be described then as one flesh. Now that that description brings into view a multifaceted relationship, but included in that surely is a fairly explicit sexual connotation or overtone. As the older, which is perhaps maybe captured in some ways better in the older English translation of cleaving. It's not exclusively a sexual idea, but that element is involved. So in other words, the relationship in which a woman is helper to man is in the marriage relationship. It's the bond, the marriage bond, in which this is realized. So that in effect, what we're being taught here, and this is clear from Jesus' commentary in the New Testament in Matthew 19, we won't take the time to look at it now. Woman is helper to her husband, not to every man. So the important principle that I think that we are bound to take away from this very fundamental passage is that the identity of woman as helper can't be carried over into every area of life. It can't be carried into other spheres of life beyond the marriage relationship, with one important exception that we'll be considering, and that is in the church. That's in the church. But with the exception of the church, you can't apply this, the identity of woman as helper, to various areas such as politics, business, education, arts, sciences, or whatever. And also, given our situation, it can't be applied either to the situation of the unmarried woman. I think that would be pushing the passage too far. Let me touch briefly then on a fourth point. Having made the point that this helper relationship is exclusive. Why does man have the need that he has? And why is woman given to man as helper? And that's a question that we can't ask ultimately in terms of their relationship to each other. But the answer to that question lies in the reference that both have to God. You have to answer this question, why the relationship between husband and wife, man and woman, in terms of its ultimate reference to God. And to try to address here very briefly a matter that probably need to spend more time on than we can, the situation is basically this, as we look not only at this passage, but in the larger context of other biblical teaching. Man, you see, was put into the creation, made in God's image. Man is put in God's creation to work, and to work toward a goal, to work in filling the earth and subduing it and replenishing it, to bring it to a certain consummation. And woman, then, you see, is given to man. Woman is complement to man to be man's helper on the way toward the goal. So the relationship described here between, in terms of woman as helper, that we need always to remember is a temporary relationship. Jesus makes that clear in Matthew 22, 30. When he describes the final eternal order, he says it's an order in which there will neither be marrying nor giving in marriage, an order that is just difficult for us to comprehend. But we are pointed to recognize that with all of the mystery that's involved. So the point then is that for the time being, the relationship between man and woman, in which woman is helper, that is, we can say, the normal, the typical relationship, but it is not essential to our identity as male and female. It's not essential to who we are as men and women. Because I believe that the teaching of the scripture is that we will carry our sexual identities, male and female, we will carry that into eternity, but we will not marry or be given in marriage. So what we have described then in the points that I've indicated is the order, the relationship that God has established at the beginning, which God then can pronounce with the creation of Adam as sort of the capstone of the creation, all very good. And it's that order then that immediately begins to become distorted, perverted, as sin comes into the picture in the next chapter. Now, as we move on in what we're trying to do here, we want to operate from another principle. And that is, as you look at the whole of the Bible and seek to see how the scriptures relate to one another, a very important principle is that the Old Testament is to be interpreted in the light of the New. The New Testament represents the end point of God's revelation. So it's very important always to be looking at the Old Testament revelation from the vantage point of God's completed revelation in the New Testament. And more specifically, how we want to apply that principle now is to go to the New Testament and look at passages that pick up on this Genesis 2 passage that we've been considering and provide, as it were, further commentary for us. And there are two passages in particular. There are four or five that we could actually say, or could say more or less, are commentaries on the Genesis 2 passage, or pick up on it. The two passages that we'll have to limit our attention to with just passing reference to the others, but the two passages we'll concentrate on are 1 Corinthians 11 and 1 Timothy 2:13. And you see, again, if you know something of the discussion that's going on, this will bring us in right into passages that are very controverted. And but that's what we're bound to do. Looking at 1 Corinthians 11, and as you're turning there, I want to underline something that I think too easily gets glossed over. It ties in with the point that I was making about Genesis 2, that you can't apply that indiscriminately to every area of life. And the same with 1 Corinthians 11. It's a situation in which Paul is concerned about the life of the church. His observations apply to male-female relationships in the church. Now, what we find in 1 Corinthians 11 is, as Paul picks up on the Genesis 2 material, is an additional idea. Paul, by his commentary, adds this thought, expressed in verse 3, that the head of the woman is man. The head of the woman is man. And that has that's in a sequence, that the head of every man is Christ on the one side. The head of Christ is God. So actually, he doesn't really follow the sequence here. The middle link, that is, the head of every man is Christ, is placed between the head of every, first of all, and then the head of the woman is man is second, the head of Christ is God third. So it sort of goes B, C, A in the sequence. And we can't explore why, just why that is. But we have to come to this point. There's been a lot of discussion about how we are to understand this reference of man as head of woman. And again, to make a long story short, and our discussion can follow up on this perhaps more than I'm saying here. I think we are bound to conclude, at least I've looked at it, I think we cannot avoid concluding that involved here is the notion of authority, the notion of leadership, head in the sense of leader. Many are trying to argue today, wanting to argue that the idea of head is that of source or origin. But I don't think, and the word head could possibly have that in some connections, but I don't think that that is the case here. I think because of the way in which the idea of head is applied in the other two expressions, if nothing else. See, Christ as the head ties into the idea of Ephesians 1, 22, for instance, that Christ is head over all things for the church. And similarly, to say that the head of Christ is God is not to say that God is the origin of Christ, but is to point to the obedience of Christ in coming as the obedient Son and servant of the Father. That, I think, is at least most likely here. And it's that, then, that explains the way Paul expresses himself. That lies in back of the way Paul expresses himself in verses 7 through 9, which have evoked, I guess you could say, even a fair amount of rebellion. A man ought not to cover his head, the situation that Paul is addressing here in the life of the congregation. We can leave to the side whether the head covering is an actual covering or a hairstyle. That differentiated between man and woman. But the reason he gives, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man, for man did not come from woman, but woman from man, neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. Now, the essential point that Paul is wanting to make here, there'd probably be a number of ways of expressing it, but I would be inclined to put it something like this. What Paul is wanting to establish is the derivative identity of woman. The derivative identity of woman. Coming out in verse 9. Man was not created for woman, but woman for man. So there is that point, and I think we're bound to face up to it in the passage. But that's not all Paul says here. At the same time, we have to bring verses 11 and 12 into the picture. In the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, so also man is born of woman. Everything comes from God. Now you see what we have then in verse 11 and 12, and I'm sure this is what Paul intends. He is wanting to qualify. He wants to qualify in verses 11 and 12 the point that he makes in verses 7 through 9, bound up with the idea of head. He wants to balance. He wants us to have a certain balance here. Now, notice what I'm saying here and what I'm not saying. I am not saying here that Paul is in contradiction with himself. It's not as if Paul is correcting himself. Or as one person put it in an article I was just reading yesterday, Paul, in verse 11 and 12, repents a little for what he just said. I don't think that gets us very far, to see Paul basically in contradiction with himself. But he is wanting to qualify. He is wanting to achieve a certain balance here. And you see, the point of verses 11 and 12 is to lay hold of an element of mutuality in the relationship between man and woman, especially as that is focused in marriage. Verses 11 and 12 express a correlativity, a correlative relationship, or perhaps a better word is the interdependence of man and woman, as that comes out very clearly in Genesis 2. So to sum up where we are coming so far in the scriptures that we have looked at, woman in relationship to man, especially as that relationship is focused in marriage, woman is both derivative and interdependent. Derivative and interdependent. Or to put that even more sharply relating these ideas, woman is both dependent and man and woman are interdependent. And that presses on us then one of those hard questions, a practical question as well as a hard question, and that is to how to put these two elements together of dependent and interdependent. And I thought of putting it this way. You can think about it. To work with the idea of mutuality, but then to bring in the notion of asymmetry. It's a mutuality which is at the same time an asymmetrical mutuality. Now that might sound like a contradiction in terms, but you see, I think what we have to try to describe here is a certain mystery, a tension of sorts. What I'm trying to get at in speaking of an asymmetrical, and that is not a perfectly even mutuality, but an asymmetrical mutuality, can perhaps be expressed this way. That the relationship between man and woman is such, particularly looking at the idea we were touching on earlier of the task that has been given to them in the creation, that relationship is a mutual sharing and burden-bearing relationship, a burden-bearing and sharing relationship, a mutual relationship in which the woman is for the man, the wife is for the husband. To put it in terms of the category of need, it's a relationship in which man needs woman and they need each other. So what we have here, what I've been trying to describe for us, what I've been trying to express is a tension, a mystery. And it's a mystery that is not going to be relieved by anyone in a few simple sentences, by some brief formula, by some stereotype or fixed set of rules on how it's supposed to work. It's a mystery. I'm inclined to put it this way. It's a tension that can only be satisfied as we actually live it out in our marriages. This thought has struck me that there's maybe a loose or rough analogy here to the question that particularly those who are more theologically minded struggle with, and that is the relationship between divine sovereignty and human responsibility. A rough correspondence, I'm saying here. You see, you can talk about that problem, particularly when you get into the beginning study of theology. You can find all different ways of expressing it, but you are always left with a mystery. And in a similar fashion here, I should go on to say, but as you mature as a Christian, as you actually live as a Christian, you come to experience these twin truths that you really can't explain to anyone else or even yourself. You come to experience the harmony or the integrity of the fact that God is absolutely sovereign and you are totally responsible. Well, in a similar way, I'm saying that perhaps this tension, this mystery is resolved for us in a satisfying way only as we live it out. This head helper relationship, this relationship of leading and helping in the relationship between man and woman, that is, I would also go on then to say that this, that relationship is one that is best worked out and worked out as both are in subjection to God, as both are subject to God in their relationship to each other. And I can't help but apply Philippians 2, what Paul says in Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4, to this whole issue that we are dwelling on here. You see, in marriage, it ought to be true most deeply what is to be true of life in the church in general. In marriage especially, in the relationship between head and helper, most deeply it ought to be true that we consider the other better than self, and that you do not look to your own interests, but to the interests of the other. Seems to me that when we bring that mindset to the relationship, then the problems, this is not an answer to everything, but the problems or the questions, the issues that we wrestle with here will be largely diminished. But see, I think if you work with the idea of the complement, and Genesis 2 doesn't say this, but I think there's, is there really any problem putting it this way? If you take man out of the picture, then the Lord God would be bound to say it's not good for woman to be alone. I think the idea is that of the complement, so that the need becomes mutual. So I think that's.
So much is being made here.
Well, I guess I'm not. The mystery is the two elements of the of man as head. See, because Paul brings that in now. If we are correctly understanding that as the idea head, the idea of leader. But you see, this is a way of putting the mystery again, if you will. The leader is in need of the one he is to lead. See, that's not usually the way we think, but you see, that's the way it's put. And I think that's the... I think the other facet of that then comes out later in the passage, that there is the interdependence. Paul is wanting to express the mutuality. Before we move to look at the 1 Timothy 2 passage, and by the way, feel free, particularly if there's something not so much... particularly if you want me to clarify something, be sure to stop me. I wanted just to add this thought as to the abuse of the truth that we have been considering. We're bound to recognize, we're bound to be sensitive, particularly as Christians, that the whole idea, the whole helper idea, has been taken and misconstrued in ways that have led to the exploitation and even the subjugation of women, to demeaning kinds of treatment, to the conclusion, drawing the conclusion that they are inferior in some way because of their helper identity. And I think it should be clear from what we have been saying how far the scripture is from that. And on that point, we can bring in the well-known verse in Galatians 3:28. What is accomplished in the gospel, what the redemption in Christ brings, is a relating not only of Jew and Gentile, slave and free, but of male and female to each other in a way that does away with must do away with all abuse and all manipulation. And we could develop that more, certainly, than I'm going to be doing here. At the same time, I want also to observe that the removal of the abuse does not mean the removal of the creation structure, which I think has too often happened, or very often happens today in the use of Galatians 3:28. And again, I think the balance here is best seen in a passage like 1 Peter 3:7. 1 Peter 3:7. Particularly the point that that women are that the creation order is not done away with. I'm assuming you're somewhat familiar with the context, and Paul says, "Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers." Now you see, Paul makes two points here, so far as Christian women are concerned, and particularly wife in relationship to husband. The wife is co-heir. Actually, we could translate even more strongly than the NIV does here, is co-heir of the grace of life. Now, you see, there's the truth of Galatians 3:28. In Christ, there's neither male or female. But at the same time, she is described as weaker partner or weaker vessel. And you see, we're bound to account for this description of the wife as weaker. It has nothing obviously to do with some kind of inferiority. It's not, I think, either, it's not either a reference to physical or psychological weakness. There's so much evidence to the contrary of that, we don't need to go into that. But it's a matter, in other words, it's not a description of the being of woman, but the function of woman in the relationship that she, where she has been established with man in marriage. The relationship of being in the relationship of dependence, or of being the non-head. Now, looking at 1 Timothy 2, which we don't really have time to do too well, but let me say a couple of things, because this brings much of our discussion for a focus so far as the life of the church is concerned. Again, let me stress that the context here is the church, the life of the church. We cannot draw implications out of this passage beyond for woman's role outside of the church. You can see that if you look at the end of chapter 3. Now, I turn you there because really, if you sat down and did an analysis of 1 Timothy 2 and 3, you would see that chapter 2, particularly beginning at verse 8, is a unit that runs all the way over through chapter 3, and chapter 3:15 is kind of the topic sentence. How people ought to conduct themselves in God's household. See, that's the general idea that Paul is working at in chapters 2 and 3. How people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, a description of the church. Now, what you have then in verse 12 is this statement, "I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent." Now, that is a clear prohibition. I don't think that there is anyone who denies that. Some have wanted to question the expression "have authority," that Paul doesn't really mean have authority, but he means shouldn't abuse authority over a man. But I don't think that will really wash here. It means what it says. It's not talking about abuse of authority, but the exercise of authority. And Paul is saying a woman is not to exercise authority over a man. So the prohibition and its terms here are fairly clear. But question has to be raised. Is it a temporary or a permanent prohibition? That is the issue that's very much debated today. There's another option that we won't consider here as not really being open for ourselves. That's the option that Paul is wrong here. We just have to correct him and go our own way. I'm assuming that we are all here to listen to Paul as God's inspired servant. But as God's inspired servant, is his prohibition temporary? In other words, is it limited to the circumstances of his own day, the situation in the church at Ephesus, which is where Timothy is, where 1 Timothy is directed, or does it have a permanent application? And many then have argued, wanted to argue, that the restriction is not permanent. It doesn't carry down to today, that it's only of a temporary character. And as I've tried to hear those arguments and to feel their weight, I cannot find them convincing. For instance, one argument is that the reason Paul prohibits here is because women were teaching falsehood. Women were being false teachers in the situation at Ephesus, and that therefore he prohibits women to speak because women were teaching error. But I think the more you think about that, that can't be a very satisfying solution. And really, in its own way, it turns around being a quite a sexist view in its own right, because it would involve Paul in prohibiting all women from speaking because of the abuse of the truth of some. If the problem were women teaching error, then why not address that issue? Why exclude women who are not prone to error and were not teaching error? Or another argument is that Paul, in view of the culture of the time, the pagan mores in which there was a low view of women, didn't want to offend the culture of his day. Now, I think that argument has a somewhat more plausibility to it. But again, I think that it's an argument that can only hold if there are not other considerations that offset it, and I think there very definitely are. I think that the command of Paul is permanent. I think it's permanent for the reasons that he gives in verses 13 and 14. Adam was formed first, then Eve. Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. Now you see, what Paul is doing here is commenting on Genesis. You see, the reason he gives for prohibiting women from speaking, exercising authority in the church, is not based on some temporary, culturally restricted factor, but his appeal has a very broad and fundamental base. He appeals to the order of creation and then what happened in the fall. His reasoning is not in any sense culture-bound here. Now, so far as the point of verse 13 is concerned, we don't really have to comment on that because we've been talking about that, what the order established in Genesis 2. But what about 14 in the way in which Paul argues there, Adam was not deceived, it was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner? Well, you've got to put that statement in the context of what Paul teaches elsewhere, where he, for instance, in Romans 5, attributes the entrance of sin into the world to Adam. And the point of verse 14 is not to suggest that women are somehow morally inferior, that women are more susceptible to temptation. That's the way in which it has often been argued in the past. But I think what Paul is trying to get at here is the inversion that took place, the inversion or the subversion of the role that was given to woman. What he describes in verse 14 is a woman who was decidedly an unhelper. Not a helper, but an unhelper. What Eve should have done was to help Adam to resist the temptation. Now, why does Paul, try to touch on this question quickly, why does Paul appeal back to the creation and fall accounts here? Why does he give this very broad basis for restricting, for the prohibition on women teaching and ruling in verse 12? Well, I think the underlying rationale, and it's important, I think, to get a hold of this point now. Otherwise, it can appear that Paul is just being very arbitrary and sort of not really very thoughtful in the argument he gives. I think what controls Paul's argument here, this presupposition, is an analogy, a unique analogy, that exists between the church and the family. Paul's controlling thought here is that the order and the role relationships that are established in the home have a carryover into the church. And that carryover, to repeat it again, is not applicable to other areas of life. It's not mandatory in other areas of life. It's just in the church that there is an analogy to the home, a carryover from family life to church life. So that Paul's point then is this, that the elders in the church, in the church are to the rest of the church as the father in the family, the father and husband in the family, is to the wife and children. And you see, that's an analogy that includes, that can carry over to the identity of everyone in the church. Because it may be true that in the church there are those who are not wives, as there are those who are not husbands. But everyone in the church is a son or a daughter, and can relate in terms of the parallel to the elders as father. Now this analogy, if we had more time to do it, we could show is rooted in the biblical doctrine of the covenant, an idea that is just pervasive through the scriptures, particularly the Old Testament. And it's particularly in terms of the doctrine of the covenant that we find the comparison between the family and the church, that God is the God is the father of his people. And we need always to remember that, by the way. This is kind of an aside, but I can't resist making the point. The church is not an aggregate of individuals. The church is not a collection of individual believers. The church is a family. The church is the church as an institution is believers and their children. That, by the way, is why we baptize our children, but that's for another evening. And you see, that brings me back to 3:15 again. This shows how this idea of the family is very much in Paul's mind looking at the church, how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household. Now, we've seen the rationale for Paul's prohibition of women speaking and ruling, but we've seen speaking and ruling in the church. And that means then that we have to go on, and I need to say just a little bit here about the limitation that is on Paul's prohibition. That while the prohibition is clear, it does have very definite limitations. And here again, I'll just have to leapfrog around the New Testament a bit, and we won't be able to do careful study. But if you look at 1 Corinthians 11, for instance, in that passage we found earlier, we find women, in fact, speaking in church. We find women praying and prophesying. And there would be other indications we can take that then as an indication of what was fairly typical or fairly normal in the church. We have, not in a church assembly, but we have the activity of Priscilla in Acts 18, involved in teaching Apollos. And I think, to make a long story short here, is that what Paul, the teaching that Paul is prohibiting to women in the church is official teaching. That is official in the sense of that teaching which belongs to special office in the church. And here I think it's important for us to see the connection between the end of chapter 2 and chapter 3. You see, what Paul does after having made the prohibition and giving the support for it at the end of chapter 2, what he does is go over in chapter 3 then to talk about those offices that are to be established in the church, beginning with the office of elder. So you see that the movement of Paul's thought here is that what he prohibits to women at the end of chapter 2, he makes a positive provision for, authoritative teaching, the rule in the church in the office of elder. Now, that brings us to a point where I think we can draw a conclusion then that can provide a base then at least for some discussion. Maybe before I do that, if you could bear with me just a minute, I should make a comment on verse 15 because a couple of people have asked about that. Verse 15 of chapter 2. Women will be kept safe through childbirth, or as we should translate, I think, be saved through childbirth if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. Now, that is proved to be a very puzzling verse. And I think that we should recognize these things at least about it. Paul here is pointing to woman's identity as a wife and a mother, and that contrasts positively with what is prohibited in verse 12. So he is saying, to put it kind of crassly, but I think this gets at the nub of things, Paul is saying that a woman should not be an elder in the church, but a mother. And I think, you see, that's in keeping with the family church analogy that Paul is developing. But see, I can't leave it just with the way I put it, because I think you have to be careful of the implications that you draw from just from the basic point, not an elder, but a mother. You've got to be sure that you don't push that beyond what Paul is saying. He is not saying that even in the church, the wife's whole identity is as a wife or a mother. That would be carrying the statement too far. He is not saying here that the wife is to find her whole identity in the home. You see, too often a verse like this is picked up on, and the point is made that the woman is to find her identity as wife and mother. And then I can think, for instance, of a sermon I heard just recently on this passage, making a strong point about how women, under the cultural movements of our day, women have to be content with being a wife and a mother so that they can save the home. Now, what struck me in that sermon is that absolutely nothing was said about the responsibility of the father-husband. Presumably, he has something to do with preserving the home. And you see, I think the idea is can be found in the church that a man is a husband, father, plus, and a woman is a mother, wife, period. And I think that is just the kind of conclusion that you can't draw from this statement. It's pushing it too far. We are, we can, we, as we are bound to recognize that a man is a husband, father, plus, so a woman is also a wife, mother, plus, with those added dimensions to her life, the full dimensions to her life that are to also characterize a man. Now, conclusion to all this. Christian women share the gift of the Spirit. They share in gifts given by the Spirit. To use Peter's language in the passage we looked at, they are not only heirs of life, they are co-heirs of life. Co-heirs of life. That carries with it the conclusion that women have been given biblical insight. They have the ability to instruct, to communicate truth to others, including men. Priscilla would be the example of that. They have the capacity to counsel others, including men. And this is the whole side of the matter that I haven't developed so fully in looking at the key passages that we have. But it seems to me that we're brought then to the place that we have to recognize that there should be a place in the life of the church for the exercise of the full range of these gifts, short of any exercise that would usurp, undermine the authority and rule, the authority, the rule, and teaching, which is reserved not for men, but for the elders, for the special office. The life of the church should have a place for the full exercise of the gifts that have been given to women, short of anything that would undermine the special office. Okay, now that's easy to say, in a sense. And immediately, many gray areas open up here. But I think these are just, these gray areas are those areas that the church needs to wrestle with, issues that the church needs to wrestle with today. And as we wrestle with them, I think within the church, then we need to bear with one another. And by bearing with one another, I think we need to be ready to tolerate a spectrum of differences that are permissible differences as to what women are or are not to do in the life of the church. Well, I have spoken more than long enough, so I'll stop here, and I'd like to have us pick it up and take it any way, any direction you like in the minutes that we have. Yes, I would, to take an example, and this would be a more controversial one, I think, at least in some circles. It's not clear to me. Well, let me put it this way. It seems to me that any situation where it's appropriate for an unordained man to teach in the church, it ought to be appropriate for a woman to teach. Because the issue, see, with the point, perhaps it wasn't clear, the point I was trying to make in 1 Timothy 2, the prohibition to silence is not women against set over against men, but women with reference to the special office. And it seems to me where the officers of the church, where the elders of the church, in their authority, determine, say, that a Sunday school is going to be conducted in such a way, and that that non-ordained instruction can be carried out, then I think that ought to be seen as open to women. Well, I'd be interested in what other people might think on that. It's just that I think probably to begin with is just the recognition of that women have gifts and that then there are ways that must be found to see. A principle that weighs very heavily with me is that the whole matter of spiritual gifts, the gifts that the Spirit gives to the church, are not, so to speak, say a gift that I have is not for myself, but as Paul teaches, it is to edify. So in other words, what is given and what is received is to be given to others. And I think that I don't have any, this isn't something I've done a lot of thinking about. I haven't really been forced to do a lot of thinking about. I don't have any specific program as to how to implement that, and I'm not sure that there's any one program. You're pressing me to be practical. I really appreciate that, and I'm just glad my wife isn't here, because she would have some somewhat snide comment to make about the practice.
I was just wondering if there were any examples of maybe churches that...
No, I guess I don't really have anything specific to, or specific example there.
Interpretation?
Yeah, I'm not aware of too much being done at the formal General Assembly study level in the PCA. Now, in the OPC, of which I'm a member, there's a study committee, has been a study committee at work that is focusing particularly on the issue of women in special office. And that is because that's become such a more controversial issue. But I think the real fruitfulness for our church, for the OPC and in other churches, would be to not to keep attention focused on that issue, because I think it could be fairly, that can be fairly clearly settled from the scriptures. I indicated that briefly, a line of argument tonight, the office of deacon, that could be a more debatable question, but I think it would be most fruitful to get off that question and get really to what I think is really the related and what is really the more a relevant question as to how to make better use, or how women are to be encouraged in exercise of gifts in a non-ordained capacity. Yeah, I'm just one person. I am definitely not Mr. OPC. There would probably be a spectrum. I think that, well, for whatever this is worth, I usually find myself in most discussions in the church somewhere in the middle between various kind of a spectrum, and I think that there would probably be people who would want to say what I'm saying, people who would feel that maybe I haven't gone far enough, who would maybe even be more open to ordination, and others who would feel that the restriction I have put on the helper model to home and marriage is compromising, and that, you know, they would have a problem with Margaret Thatcher, or, you know, us voting for a woman president, whatever. So I think that's, you know, and I think that's what we're going to continue to counter for a long, or probably in my lifetime. Most of you will live longer. There's just going to be a difference of opinion, and that's why I ended up on one thing I did want to say is the need for us all, where we can recognize that there is a genuine, thoughtful desire to be submissive to the scriptures, to live with a certain amount of difference. One congregation, one session. See, I think ultimately it comes back, as Presbyterians, it comes back to the accession and its authority. I think one session is going to make different decisions than another in implementing, and I think that one congregation has to learn to live beside another and not become overbearing or critical. Well, I can give a quick answer. It's hard to get away from the point that Paul does, as I put it earlier, he sets woman's identity as a mother, that's the positive part, to the negative of no rule in the church. But as I also wanted to say, I think when you take that in the context of Scripture, that's not saying that woman has her identity exclusively as a mother. So I don't think that you could establish an obligation just from this passage, but I do think that in the light of scriptures, in the light of God's covenant, that God does not just save individuals, but he saves the believers and their seed, that there is an obligation to, in general, to produce seed. Now, what that means in terms of, you get into issues of birth control and so on here. I think that, again, there can be, I don't think, that mandates, it's going to be left up to each parent, to each couple to determine responsibly before the Lord what that means. But I think that is an obligation, I think that you're asking for an autobiographical sort of thing. I think probably the most, I don't know if this happened just in the last 10 years or so, but the struggle that my wife and I have gone through, not so much, not between each other, but particularly my wife wrestling with a lot of these issues and pressing me for answers. You're the theologian, tell me. And coming to see that some of what I think we we come from out of a pretty similar background and so on, that the limitations, particularly on her exercise of gifts, not so much in the church, but outside the home, had been unnecessarily restricted. So I think it's been, that's been a very satisfying kind of thing, and has I think, opened me up and made me sensitive to a lot of issues that I wouldn't otherwise have. I'm not quite sure how I'd answer the question beyond the ordination question. I guess putting substance to the generalization that I made here in the gray areas, how do we push in the life of the church, as I think we ought to, for a greater activity of women without compromising the authority of the special office? I can see that can raise some pretty tricky issues. And I don't have anything so specific there, but I just, I think that's something I need to do a lot of thinking about. That can be a hard question, and yet I think the answer is better seen, you get at the answer that I think better by focusing on what biblical worship is. And I think that that while, particularly in a Presbyterian tradition, there has been a tendency to become somewhat artificial in a distinction between informal and formal worship, I think that is a distinction that is to be maintained on the basis of Scripture. And I think that there is that that worship, that assembly of God's people with the elements that are to constitute worship, in which the proclamation of the word is to be central, I think that is entrusted not just to anyone, but to the special office. Yet at the same time in saying that, it's just on the basis of the New Testament, I can't say that it would be wrong, to put it negatively, that it would be wrong for a woman to, well, you can take the example of, a missionary reporting, a woman missionary reporting in a worship service. And other involvement of women in worship, I think that there would be, Paul says in the assembly in 1 Corinthians 11, women were praying. I think in some congregations that would be a real problem. But I think that the special office, see, rule in the church is rule by the word. That's the only way the rulers in the church can rule. They don't have any other authority than the authority of the word. That's the authority of special office, is the authority of the word. And I would say there is that proclamation of the word that has been entrusted to the elders, and that has to be preserved. Now, then you can always come around and ask me what distinguishes the one from the other. And I'm not sure that you can always give a clear answer to that. Yeah, I guess I would tend to look at it more from, should that be happening?
Like at the unordained marriage?
Yes. Should those other than licentiates or those ordained be in the pulpit? You have to protect, the distinctiveness of the proclamation of the word, which is assigned, reserved for the special officers. And now maybe you would have a gathering of the church where someone non-ordained would speak, and I'm not going to say that that's always wrong. But I think that's an abnormality so far as the order that the New Testament establishes in the church, which is for the elders to teach and to rule through their teaching. But I feel the problem that you're raising. Yeah, well, if I wasn't clear at the beginning, I'd want to emphasize that the helper identity is something that is taken on in a woman is not a helper by birth, she's a helper by marriage. And I think that single women ought not then to be burdened with a certain false conception of a helper identity, especially as that would be applied outside the areas of family and church in the direction of perpetuating the injustices that we're all aware of that take place in the job market and so on. Well, that would happen to married women as well, but then I think it's not a problem within the church, because as I've thought to put it, a single woman, just as much as a married woman, is a daughter, has had a father, is a daughter, and can relate to the elders just as well as a single man could, for instance. So that just in general.
What should be the role of the single woman then in the church? Not different from the married, I suppose.
No, basically not different, right? I can't really think of anything. The kinds of teaching that would come up, the kinds of ministries, other ministries of mercy, and how I think that they would be equally open. And in fact, it seems in the New Testament church that there is not so much singleness, but it's particularly the widows that were given a specially active role in 1 Timothy.
Yeah.